Good morning, everyone. The Government Operations and Elections Committee will come to order for the first time in 2012. Yes. Welcome back. It's glad to see y'all.
See you.
Hope you had a nice interim. Just for a little housekeeping, we do have a few new staff that I'd like to introduce. And we'll start maybe with my new CLA, Kelly Hansen, who is a recent law school graduate from St. Thomas, and maybe she could just say hi and introduce herself.
Hi, I'm Kelly Hansen. I just recently graduated from St. Thomas Law School. Looking forward to a great year.
Okay. And Dave Sullivan, who is doing DFL research this year. Welcome, Dave. If you could just tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm David Sullivan. I'm staffing this committee for DFL research, at least for a while. And I'm a recent U of M Law School graduate, if you consider 1998 recently. So it's actually been a while. I also staff Commerce Committee, Jobs, and Ways and Means.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. And we have two pages. I'm not sure if they'll both be here all session, but we have Pat back again, at least temporarily. He's a veteran, of course. And then Ryan Scar. If you could just maybe, if the two of you could just briefly say hi and a little bit about yourself.
I'm Ryan. I graduated from Hamline in 09 and the University of Liverpool this past December.
Oh, wow.
I'm Pat. It's my second year as a page, and I'm just helping out today, but Ryan will be here from the page of this committee.
Wonderful. Welcome to the committee, and hopefully we'll have another fun session. I think we'll start with minutes, approval of the minutes. Anyone get a chance to review the minutes of May 17, 2011?
Madam Chair, I'd move approval.
Representative Murray moves approval of the minutes. Do we have any suggestions or comments or changes? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes of May 17, 2011, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Minutes are approved. We have a... Is there any other housekeeping here? Okay. We have a pretty busy agenda because, of course, we have such a short session, so, and then a few little breaks. So we're going to be probably fairly aggressive in trying to bring some bills forward. Four bills today. We'll start out with House File 389, our own Representative Beard, if you want to move the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My motion is to move House File 389, recommend it pass, and be referred to the General Register.
Okay. Representative Beard moves his bill. Please proceed.
Thank you. Madam Chair, now that the bill is in front of us, in your packets, members, you will see that there is an A2 amendment, which has the effect of being a delete all amendment. Madam Chair, I'd like to move the amendment A2. That'll put the bill in the form for which we could have discussion today.
Okay, Representative Beard moves the A2 amendment. Does anyone have a problem with us, since that's a delete everything amendment, to move forward with it? Representative Sanders?
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, I'm not sure. I have two A2s in my packet. Is that just duplicates, or are there?
There is only one, Madam Chair. Perhaps Mr. Koch could explain it.
All right. Representative Beard has moved the A2 amendment. All those in favor of moving the A2 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. We are on to the A2 amendment to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for amending it for discussion purposes today. The House File 382 was introduced last year, a companion bill to Senate File 270, which has already passed the Senate. But here I think we wanted to have a little more discussion about a couple of the concepts in the bill. Many of you know, if you've probably been hearing, I'm sure, some consternation about prohibiting or altering the ability for municipalities to do what we call interim ordinances. I call them moratoriums on development or on projects that are coming forward. Madam Chair, on the City Council, when I was a City Council member in Shakopee, which was one of the fastest growing cities in Minnesota for many years, there was a time when we were awash in development proposals that were coming forward. And I remember right at the end of my service there, when the City Council actually did move a moratorium on developments, but we were very clear that any development proposal that was in the pipeline and had already pulled their permits and were working with city staff, those developments were to move ahead under the existing rules, but perhaps we wanted to alter the rules going forward, so we put a moratorium on new proposals and new developments, which at the end of the day many of us thought was ultimately fair, and the succeeding city council after my service did approve that moratorium, I believe, for a year, so that they could kind of come up for air and talk about changes they might have wanted to make. But to be clear, it was our assumption or our considered opinion that it was fair, because folks who are playing by the rules continued to have their proposals move ahead under the existing rules. We didn't change the rules in the middle of the game, and that is my purpose for bringing the bill forward. Madam Chair, as you'll hear here shortly, a couple of anecdotal stories where projects in good faith have been brought forward, and only to have a city council's try to attempt to change the rules in the middle of the game, which leads to court action, which leads to unnecessary expense. Madam Chair, I think there's a way we can refine the process for cities, counties, and townships so that we can allow property owners to defend their rights, protect their ability to have, hold, and use their property as they see fit, and still protect the neighbors and the government that does exist, and protect their ability to define how the land can be used, particularly as it relates to others around. The House file that you see has, delete all amendment does a couple of things. I hope that you'll find that it's a reasonable reform for greater efficiency for land use and regulatory process improvements. It'll also it touches on developers agreements, and I think in talking to the folks at the League of Minnesota Cities Association of Metropolitan Counties and the Township Association, although they think there's nothing wrong with the way things work now, I think you'll hear testimony shortly that says that it can be made just a little bit better, a good process can be improved upon. That's what the section on developers agreements does. And then there's some clarifying language on park fees regarding park fees that I believe you'll find represents some of the latest rulings in some court cases that will be discussed shortly. Madam Chair, with that, I'd like to introduce my first testifier in favor of House File 389. That would be our friend, Mr. Peter Coyle. If I could ask him to identify himself and testify, that would be great.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Coyle.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Coyle. I'm a lawyer lobbyist with Larkin Hoffman, and I represent the Builders Association of the Twin Cities. With me are two other testifiers, Jason McCarty from Westwood Professional Services, who's a civil engineer and the chair of the Public Policy Committee for BATSE, as well as Ian Peterson, who's the director of land development for Pulte Homes and a member of the Public Policy Committee at BATSE. While Representative BAM is not sitting with us this morning, I believe it's fair to say that BAM, as a statewide builders organization, is also in support of this bill. BATSE and BAM represent builders and remodelers of homes, whether they're single family, whether they're townhomes, whether they're multifamily. And they build homes all over the state, although the last 3 or 4 years, as you all know, has been really difficult for the housing economy. The National Home Builders Association has completed a study that indicates that between 20 and 35% of the cost of building a home is attributable to regulatory control, either costs associated with the process, many of which are legitimate, but also, as important, the cost of delay or sometimes the cost of missed opportunity. And that's really what's at the heart of this bill. We're trying to provide some meaningful reforms that strike a fair balance between the opportunity that private sector folks who want to put their money at risk and build housing are willing to do, provided they play by the rules, but not be penalized for having done so. I'm going to testify in the moratorium discussion, which I think is where you're going to see most of the friction this morning, candidly. And I'll just start by saying we think the cities and the counties and towns are partners in seeing housing developments go forward. And while we disagree on this particular issue this morning, we work with them very routinely, and we are working with them on this bill. Last year's variance legislation, which you'll all recall, was a very good example of how the builders and the public sector folks worked very cooperatively to try to pass much-needed legislation in this area. So with that, the delete all that's before you represents already a series of compromises that have been struck with primarily the cities. I'm not going to go through those in detail unless you have questions, but I just wanted to give you an example of within the last 72 hours, we've made changes that the cities requested of us to try to strengthen the bill, make it more acceptable to them as a gesture of good faith. The moratorium piece continues to be the sticking point, and that is that's the portion of the bill that you'll find at line 316, primarily, at line 316 and at line 4.1. And I just want to explain the moratorium process for you for just a minute, and then I'll explain the language change. Today, a city, county, or town has statutory authority to enact the development moratoria that's good for at least 12 months, virtually at will, as long as they can tie it to a legitimate planning purpose. So if a city council member or a town board member shows up at a meeting and says, you know, I got a concern, they can adopt a moratorium immediately if they choose to. And the property owners who are affected by that have no recourse, and they're basically stuck for a minimum of 12 months, and if you're in a county, possibly 24 months. The problem becomes that sometimes the business owner, the property owner, doesn't know that a moratorium is coming until they've already submitted their application based on what they understand the rules to be today. And then they find out midstream, after they've spent all their money on the land, they spent their money on engineering, they spent their money on architectural work, that somebody in the city or the county or the town doesn't much like what they're proposing. And they're at the complete mercy of the local government in that setting if they choose to put a moratorium on them. And for the most part, their project is killed unless they have the financial wherewithal or the patience to wait out the moratorium, hoping that the rules are not changed on them. I'll give you two examples of the maybe extremes, but they're still real examples. Within the last 12 months, we represented a school district in northern Minnesota on a school building project. The county had primary zoning authority for the project. It not only went through multiple hearings at the county, it also was a mandatory EAW category, so it had to go through full environmental review. That whole process took about 12 months. The local township folks opposed the project, participated in the whole process, but once the county approved it, then the township, which had no zoning role up to that point, then the township chose to adopt a development moratorium to try to derail the project. The project was completely finished at that point, but the school district had to stop, waste another couple of months, had to hire lawyers to sue the township, and that was a colossal waste of money and time at the expense of the school district, which was already struggling to make sure that they could stick on schedule and budget. That's one example. Second example was more painful because I was directly involved with this fellow. I represented an industrial contractor here in the Twin Cities who had a piece of property that he'd owned for a very long time. It was a zoned industrial. He wanted to simply build a shed on his property so he could put his equipment inside. You'd think that would be a terrific deal. Unfortunately, the local council member who represented the area didn't like the fact that the contractor was even there. So when he realized that the guy had submitted all of his application materials, including a $60,000 plan that the city required of him, he asked the council to adopt a moratorium, which they did immediately, and the staff refused to issue him a building permit. Then the city proceeded to change the rules, and he couldn't go forward with his project at all. So he was out somewhere between $60,000 and $80,000, and he has no recourse. That's what the courts have said. He has no recourse. So the amendment that is reflected in the A2 dealing with counties and cities and towns would simply say that if you make a complete application based on the rules that those jurisdictions establish and they accept the application for processing, if they choose to adopt a moratorium going forward for some reason, God love them, they can, there's nothing that stops them, but they've got to let the person who made the compliant application proceed, and they can still vote it up or down as they choose. If the application has traffic problems, if it has environmental problems, if it's missing some key element, they can still reject the project just as they can today. The only change that comes out of that is the person's entitled to a vote based on the rules that were established by the local jurisdiction as of this moment. If they want to change the rules going forward for the next guy through the door, they have all the authority that they have today. That's it. Now, that poses a very fundamental policy question, because today they can do it unilaterally and the private property owner or the business owner is completely at risk. We're trying to find a middle balance point that respects the interest of the private business owner or the property owner, but doesn't take away the authority of the regulatory body to govern itself and set its rules for its jurisdiction. Once they make the rules, we have to follow them, and we understand that. But they should also be bound by the rules as they exist up to that point. Those are my comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is the gist of the bill, but I do have two other folks to testify briefly to this, if I may.
Okay, we do have one a question from a member, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. What I've been hearing from a lot of people who are opposed to this bill, and I've been getting lots of emails on it,
that their one of the concerns that they continually raise with me is, what about the triple X shop that somebody wants to open, the bookstore, peep show, whatever, that they've gone through the process and then they find out at the end that, well, that's not what we thought it was. And they're saying that, well, then this could go on and they wouldn't be able to stop it. Would this bill have any effect on that?
Mr. Coyle.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a great question. The A2 reflects a change from the original bill, and it specifically carves out adult uses and public nuisances as exceptions. If a city or a county or a town finds itself confronted by one of those applications, they would still be able to impose the moratorium as they can today. That would not change. So that you can find that language at lines 3.21 and 4.7. So that's a change to the bill.
Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, Nelson, and Representative Beard, remember when Representative Birdall famously carried that legislation a couple, three, four, five, 6 years ago, time flies, and I think addressed that, but perhaps he'd like to speak to that.
Representative Birdall.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Beard. I do appreciate that you do remember that, and I did spend the dollar bill you stuffed in my pocket as I was giving that talk.
I knew you would.
But, yes, we did pass into law a piece of legislation that makes it difficult for these types of institutions and enterprises to be established.
Okay. Representative Hornstein had a question as well. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Similarly, I guess we could all look at different industries that we have or land uses that we have concerns about, but one of mine as it relates to this bill is, we have, just for example, in southeast Minnesota lately, a proliferation of interests that are involved in mining sand, and I think this relates to an industry in Representative Beard and I's home areas of Pennsylvania, Ohio, the fracking that's going on there. So they ship the sand out there to the Ohio Valley. And so these are very large and they're disruptive, and it's my understanding that Winona and Wabasha and Goodhue counties have passed interim ordinances to address this issue. And so how would this legislation affect that? And again, these are very, very issues that are causing a lot of concern, and we have this in local areas of the state. This isn't, it's different than, I think, what your constituency, Mr. Coyle, is concerned about, but yet this this affects it very dramatically. And so as you look at moving forward, this is very broad, and so are there ways to fine-tune this legislation so that these kinds of issues and problems and land uses are addressed? Because this is an issue that's not going away. We in the Bluff Country in Minnesota, and I think also in Wisconsin, have really become kind of an epicenter for the sand mining. And there's probably other examples I could give that would be impacted by this legislation, but that's one that's really on my mind now. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in how you would respond to that.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hornstein, thank you for the question. The ability for any township, city, or county to lay a moratorium on to discuss things that are changing in the world of development or mining or anything like that will not change if this bill is passed. The only thing that will change is if a township, city, or county allows sand and gravel mining to take place now as a permitted use on a certain kind of property, and somebody applies for a permit to do that, they couldn't be stopped in their tracks by somebody throwing a moratorium up. Now, the city, township, or county can accept the permit, hold hearings, and find something else might be wrong. For instance, their stormwater plan might not be sufficient, transportation plan might not be sufficient. But what this gets at is it prevents the passion of the moment from being able to wear people down and break them financially just because somebody's mad at them or doesn't like the fact that they're not going to sell sand to the glass plant, but, oh, by the way, they're going to sell it to an oil company now. Sometimes the moratoriums are thrown on for something that vague or that whimsical, I guess I could say. If you don't want to have sand mining or you want that to be a conditional use permit, put a moratorium on, change the zoning laws, and everybody plays by the same rules. All this does is protect people who are playing by the rules that exist at the moment from being blindsided by a moratorium that then wears them down. If they are playing by the rules and their permit is not sufficient or the locality determines there is some deficiency, the good news is they can still turn them down. They just have to do it within a shorter window of time. I think the maximum is 120 days, and perhaps Mr. Coyle can speak more expertly to that if he needs more clarification.
Representative Hornstein.
Well, thank you, Representative Beard. And, you know, I mentioned, I think, before the hearing that I have concerns about the bill. But, you know, if it were to move forward, I guess I would just ask, you know, and you had mentioned, and I think it's very helpful, that including the township representatives and, and the League of Cities, et cetera. But I would just also ask to also include, I know that the Farmers Union and Land Stewardship Project and the Minnesota Environmental Partnership also have concerns. And if they can be included in your conversations, because I think they could give even more examples besides the sand mining that, you know, may be impacted by this. I would just ask that they be
certainly
included as you move forward, if this were in fact to move forward.
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, yes, one of those organizations has a meeting with me shortly after this meeting convenes today, or adjourns today. So yes, you know that I will do that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Quayle?
Madam Chair, Representative, I wanted to just comment further on that point. I have met over the years, and this is an issue that's been in the background as an issue for all of us for the last 4 or 5 years. So there's been lots of discussion about this with the counties and the cities and the towns, and the environmental community has also had an opportunity to weigh in over the years. But candidly, respectfully, this is the first committee that's been able to hear this bill, which we appreciate. But having said that, we're willing to work with anybody that's got a concern. We've already agreed to make, with the author's permission, a bunch of changes based on requests that were made. And I've asked them, particularly with the moratorium language, if they have a proposal for how they can tighten it so they can avoid being surprised themselves, we're willing to work with them on it. But I'd like them to show us what they think they could accept.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And we do have one more member question. I just like to point out that we've got a couple more people that you have speaking, Representative Beard, and I know we have several people that wanted to speak with some concerns about the bill, so just keep that in mind as we go forward with questions. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Speaking of vague, I guess Representative Beard, like you, I've spent a long time on the City Council, and I think that it's such a helpful background for someone in the legislature, because we've seen how these types of things might apply because of our experience in those areas. And I see that the A2 amendment goes from takes the bill from 4 pages to 8 pages. So I've got some real questions about the parkland dedication addition of this. And sometimes I think when we put in delete all amendments like that, you know, we fulfill the requirements of when we see it here at committee, but we always don't, it doesn't always, isn't always helpful for local governments to see things like this come in at the last minute. So I definitely have some concerns about that. But when you talked about vague, I think that there's a couple of lines in here that are really vague. I'm not an attorney, but I think that this would be good fodder for attorneys. It would be line 3.16 and lines 4.1, which states, an interim ordinance or map must not halt, delay, or impede consideration of a use, et cetera, that's pending. That seems to me pretty darn vague, and I'm not sure that that's tight enough to not wind up in court for an extended period of time. And how would you address that?
Mr. Coyle.
Madam Chair, Representative, let me deal with the park language first that you started with. I want to let you know that that piece of the legislation is largely recodification language. Your counsel can confirm that to you. There are some changes that were made based on conversations that we've had with the League of Minnesota Cities, and it relies primarily, and these two testifiers can speak to it as well, but it addresses primarily how the valuation of land and the adjustment of park fees can be done. There's already a valuation requirement in statute. We're trying to modify it to make it work better. So I would say respectfully, and the city folks can testify themselves, I don't think that the park language by itself is really a source of controversy. It's primarily a recodification, frankly, to make it easier to read. As to the moratorium language, I would just make the offer I made before. We're willing to work with anybody in trying to make that application process be cleaner. We've used the complete application standard because that's already in law, and it puts the jurisdiction in full control as to whether or not to accept an application for processing. If you've not given something that they're entitled to, they can just kick it back. But if there's a way to improve it, to avoid the ambiguity, we'll work with you.
Follow-up, Representative Scalzi.
And I guess just what I think might be the unintended consequences of something like this is that a city, it may actually impede development, unintended, because I think local governments, cities, townships, and counties might be a little bit more gun-shy about accepting an application without a study or some research because of the fact that they might be blindsided by a new use that isn't in their ordinances. And it gives away the local control from the local government, in some cases, to a developer who may have a lot more research and knowledge on the issue than the local government would. And it would take them some time to obtain some of that knowledge, and they may be gun-shy.
Well,
Mr. Coyle.
Madam Chair, Representative, we're not interested in trying to propagate a gotcha-type bill on the reverse side. I'm trying to protect the property owner who gets the gotcha today, and they bear 100% of the risk. We're trying to find a happy medium in there. So if we haven't struck the right balance yet, we're open to suggestions for how that can be improved.
Thank you. Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, perhaps we can briefly have, I know you've got three more bills you want to hear today, too, and but I want to give this the dwell time it needs. You know how that's how I like to work. But I do have two other testifiers I'd like to speak briefly to some of these issues, and perhaps that will help address some of the questions we've just heard. Should I introduce Mr. Jason McCarty from Westwood and have him say a few words, Madam Chair?
Okay. Welcome to the committee, Mr. McCarty. If you and all the witnesses could be brief, that would be very much appreciated by the committee.
Absolutely.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jason McCarty. I am with a company called Westwood Professional Services. We work with builders and developers to build new neighborhoods. I also serve on the board of the Builders Association of the Twin Cities, and I serve as their volunteer public policy chair. Much of what I was going to talk about was already touched on with questions and testimony. Just to be very brief on a couple of items. Regarding the moratoria, I really feel that it's just it's a fairness issue. The rules are established in the application. The ordinance are set up, and when an applicant makes an application with those rules in mind, the feeling is that if you follow the rules, you'll at least get heard and have an opportunity for your project to be considered for approval. One example that comes to me from a few years ago during the housing boom, there was a local suburb that was absolutely inundated with applications for new townhome developments. And these developments were largely set up in areas that were zoned for townhome development, and the city had their standards set up for those. However, the city was overwhelmed with applications. The staff was overwhelmed. The city was growing too quickly. And at the same time, there was some concern about what the townhomes ended up being and whether or not that was within the vision of the city. So they did decide to take a time out by enacting a moratoria. However, what I feel that they did was right was there were two applications that were in and pending, and those were allowed to proceed through because it was acknowledged that they had submitted their applications fairly and under the current rules. Moving on, I just want to touch briefly too on development contracts. I know most of what we're talking about is moratoria. Development contracts are an important tool for both builders and developers and cities alike. Cities are authorized by statute to tie fees to projects, and that makes sense. Builders want to pay their fair share as far as their projects and their costs. But too often developers are faced with accepting additional fees and conditions in development agreements after a project is approved. And it's really at that point it's a take it or leave it situation. You're either going to agree to these stipulations or your project's going to be stalled or it's going to be killed altogether. So with that I understand there, you know, there's many other people that would like to testify, and I will end my comments with that.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Peterson. If you could just identify yourself for the record.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ian Peterson. Vice President of Pulte Homes here in the Minnesota market. It's a pleasure to be here today. I want to touch briefly on park fees and some changes that we'd like to see. Everybody knows in the last 5 years we've seen significant decline in land values and home values, nearly 50% drop in land values, depending on the suburb that you're in the Twin Cities. With that, development fees in general, and I know we're here to talk specifically about park fees, but development fees in general have remained unchanged. And it creates a large disconnect in terms of developing the property and creating an affordable housing component. Give you one specific example. We had a 150-acre parcel under contract in the metro area. Spent a lot of time, nearly $300,000, entitling this piece of property. The development fees, and specifically the park fees on this particular project, it was a very unique parcel. But in this municipality, the park fees were based on $85,000 an acre. We had an appraiser and another developer, as well as us, show that values of land were roughly $45,000 an acre. And after 18-month process, $300,000 later, we had to walk away from the project because there was no give with regard to development fees and park fees in this particular situation. So with the legislation, having a remedy for the disconnect between park fees and the development is what we're looking for today. So I'll keep it brief and here for any specific questions anyone may have. So thank you.
I don't see any specific questions right now. Thanks for your testimony. Now I think we'll move on to some folks who want to testify to some concerns of the bill. Tom Peterson, are you here? Welcome to the committee, and if you could just identify yourself for the tape.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and I briefly did share my concerns with Representative Beard and continue to look at the new amendment. Our members support local control and the ability of local governments to put the brakes on a project if they feel it's necessary for the community and if it's not quite ready for the project. Specifically, we are concerned about how it would work if a project to go forward and allow it, if they have their application in, and it's something that the local community hasn't felt like they're ready to deal with. I'm also concerned about the part I haven't heard much talk about in the bill. There's a part about the two-thirds vote, and we've had looked at that and not sure why that's necessary, and our policy would oppose requiring a two-thirds vote too for interim ordinances. A lot of times we deal with developments out in the countryside, whether it's as we've talked about, the sand fracking, feedlots, gravel pits, racetracks, whatever comes in. You just don't know what is going to come about. I'd also say though too that just because the interim ordinance goes into place doesn't mean the project doesn't always get built. In Minnesota, we've had several, you know, and I would talk just specifically to farms, several large farms that went forward and did work with the township and, you know, and the area to address a lot of the concerns, and that just giving them the time, it is sometimes a positive thing as well. And so I just wanted to make that clear. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Peterson? Okay, we'll move on then to David Williams. Welcome to the committee. You could just identify yourself for the tape.
Madam Chair, representatives, my name is David Williams. I come to you from far southeastern Minnesota, where I'm an elected township supervisor in Preble Township. I also am chair of the board of Minnesota Environmental Partnership. MEP is the state's largest conservation and environmental organization with some 80 members representing approximately 450,000 people. most of the comments that I've heard about moratoria relate to housing development. Down in my area of southeastern Minnesota, we have the sudden proliferation of proposed silica sand mining operations. The need for moratoria, the need on the part of counties and townships is the need for agility and the ability to quickly respond without hearings, without noticed hearings, without impediments to a moratoria, to keep the status quo so that they can quickly respond and study these proposed new uses. And as the gentleman just before me indicated, there are all kinds of unexpected new uses that counties and townships have not previously planned for that need to be studied. And that is exactly why Goodhue County, Wabasha, and Winona County, and probably Houston County to come, have enacted moratoria, and that's exactly why you have several townships that have enacted moratoria. These are conservative regions. These are conservative counties that are unaccustomed to enacting moratoria that would prevent property owners, farmers, and other rural property owners from engaging in what those people want to do with their property. We are a conservative region, and so it's for conservative counties and townships to suddenly take on this tool, this land use planning tool of using moratorium, shows you that there is a need to quickly respond and study and to prevent conflict among these various uses. The proposed developer is not the only property owner. Those who are farmers, recreational users, rural residents, they are also property owners who are simply trying to protect their property value from some unexpected use that might damage their property values. In the instance of silica sand mining, the problems are potential for excessive consumption of water, contaminated water, huge heavy truck traffic, weak county and township ordinances on reclamation, air emissions problems, they're blasting. There are a number of issues that these counties and townships are now studying and need to study before they can then allow these new uses to go on. The moratoria do not provide a permanent cessation of these land uses. They are simply a first step towards studying, and my experience and certainly in talking with some of the county commissioners of these southeastern Minnesota counties, my experience is that their plan will be to allow these uses to go on by imposing conditions on the permitted uses. And that's what is needed, is the time to be able to study these new uses, to be able to develop conditions that you can later impose. Most moratoria do not result in a flat-out prohibition of land use. It just doesn't happen. I will stop there. If you have any questions of me, I'm happy to answer.
Thank you. We do have a couple member questions. Representative Kwan.
Madam Chair, if I'm understanding the current testimony, a lot of the counties appear to have issues with who the landowners wish to sell to. I live in southeastern Minnesota. Every county in that area, I believe, has at least one sand pit and one quarry. And so it appears as if there's not a problem with, my town, townships around me using sand, using aggregate from the local. So it's just who they're selling to. And I have a concern that we might, by restricting that, violate interstate commerce and other principles of denying people access to goods just because we don't, like what they might do. And so that's part of my concern about these interim ordinances that are popping up, is it's a restriction of free trade, it's a restriction of private property ownership. And in my understanding, when they're talking about the use of fracking, that's, I'm just trying to get clarification, because with the emails I'm getting, that's the impression I'm getting is it's just fracking sand use and not, other normal uses.
Mr. Williams, do you have a quick response?
Representative, Madam Chair. Certainly, in our region of southeastern Minnesota, there are a lot of small sand pits and gravel operations that are in existence primarily to provide for product for local consumption, for road repairs, road maintenance, for farms that need some lime, for bedding and other purposes. But this proposed new use of silica for silica sand mining is different, not only just in terms of what its purpose will be of taking away the sand away from the area, but it's the processing of sand within the area, the potential use of chemicals to treat the sand on site. It's the excessive water consumption and water contamination, heavy truck traffic. These are conditions of this proposed new use that do not exist with normal limestone quarries and sand operations in the area.
Thank you. Representative Winkler, and I do want to remind everyone that we do have several other witnesses. So, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe this question will help kind of guide some of their testimony. It seems to me we have two countervailing principles at stake here. One principle is that if you have rules in place and you come in with a project that fit under the rules and you do everything you're supposed to do, you're not supposed to be punished for coming forward and complying, and that we want to respect the investment that people make. And even if an interim ordinance doesn't permanently prevent the use, it does delay it, and time is money. So it does create an economic hardship. So that's one principle. The other principle is you can have new uses that weren't previously contemplated by a zoning body or a proliferation of a certain kind of use. For example, this frac sand mining that creates new challenges that also are not anticipated by the current zoning ordinance. And somewhere you have to find a balance between those two principles. I'm not convinced that the current language of the bill quite does that yet, because I think this language essentially puts the burden on the zoning ordinance authority to come up to kind of imagine all the possible uses or all the possible proliferation of uses. And they might not be able to do that. And so a new application comes and they want to study it. And this is just a suggestion. I guess I would submit it to your reaction. But what if an interim ordinance could be adopted, even if the landowner comes in and makes technically complies with the rules? If the city council makes some sort of finding that this is a substantially different use than was anticipated in the current code, or it's a substantial expansion of the existing use, and that finding by the city could be challenged into some sort of expedited fashion. It seems to me that somewhere in between, there has to be some way of balancing these two principles that are at stake, and perhaps of some sort of fact-finding that has to be done by the city, put in writing, and that is something that could be challenged on appeal. Could be a way of drawing those two things together. It seems to me that's what we're hearing from the testimony, unless Mr. Williams thinks I'm totally wrong about that, but it sounds like that's kind of what he was talking about as well. Mm-hmm.
Representative Winkler, who did you want to respond?
Well, Mr. Williams might be able to.
I would be happy to respond.
Mr. Williams.
One of the problems with some of these new uses is that the comprehensive land use plans in these counties and townships does not anticipate any of this. And that's the basis for the ordinances that have existed for these counties and townships, is based upon that plan. And so there's a need to revise the plan with these unanticipated new uses, not to just allow a very stealthy proposed developer to come in and apply for a CUP without first being able to the government unit to be able to study it. And the other thing I might say also is that these moratoriums are not going to last forever. Winona County just adopted a 90-day moratorium, and so they are determined to try to study the use. I know Winona County commissioners who will quickly get to the point of determining the needs for new rules and regulations.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Beard, if you don't mind, we're really running short on time. Would you mind if we took some more witnesses and then you could wrap up or kind of make concluding comments later, if that would be all right.
I'll wrap my comments, Representative Mick Winkler's comments, into my closing comment.
Thank Wonderful. You. Bobby King. Mr. King, if you could just, since we're so pressed for time and have three bills ahead of us, if you could keep them brief as well, your comments.
My name is Bobby King. I'm representing the Land Stewardship Project. And I'll try to be brief, and I try not to repeat stuff that's already been made. Just wanted to say that the Land Stewardship Project is opposed to this bill because we fundamentally believe that local governments need to be fully empowered to respond to citizens' concerns when unexpected and potentially harmful development is proposed in their communities. And I think that's one of the key concepts here. Representative Winkler hit on it, and Mr. Williams, unexpected development. A lot of the examples were around developments that were previously anticipated by the zoning ordinance, but in the cases I'm familiar with where the interim ordinance was needed was a proposal came forward that the ordinance didn't anticipate, and we can't expect every township and county to anticipate every potential new uses. And examples are the frac sand mine, of course. Racetracks is another one. There was a big push to put racetracks in rural Minnesota. Ordinances didn't address it. Large-scale feedlots have been an ongoing problem. They used to be more of a problem, but most counties have adopted some type of zoning around that. Our major concern with the bill are these, that allowing someone who has their application before the local unit of government to be exempt from an interim ordinance enacted after that defeats in many cases the purpose of the interim ordinance, because that's how you become made aware that your ordinance is not sufficient, that someone put something on the table like the frac sand mining that's beyond the scope of anything that's been considered in that area. The two-thirds majority we think is problematic, and ordinances should pass by a simple majority. The other thing is the public notice could dramatically slow down the ability of the local unit of government to act the interim ordinance in a timely manner. And the interim ordinances I'm aware of, the ones in Winona County, Wabasha, Goodhue, those didn't happen quickly. And the ones I'm aware of don't happen quickly. The townships and counties are cautious about adopting them. A township official, I wanted to give just two examples that haven't been mentioned. And there was a township official who emailed everyone a letter, and I, in case you didn't get it, I brought copies here. Lynn Misner's from Aiken County, Logan Township, and a garbage burner was proposed in their township. And local folks couldn't get answers from the developers about how much truck traffic, how you're going to handle it. And they were talking about bringing in 300 tons of municipal solid waste and tires per day. I mean, it was going to dramatically change the nature of this township. And this brings up an issue that hasn't been addressed. The township at that time had no zoning. They thought up to that point the county had done a sufficient job for them. On this, they began to realize the county was not going to look out for their township, it felt like. So they had their only recourse to have a say as a township was the interim ordinance, which they adopted, and then they're in the process of developing ordinances.
Maybe I could just interrupt you there. I know Representative Scalzi had a question.
Okay, all right.
Well, I just had a question. I know when I hear the two-thirds, but in effect, you know, small towns all across Minnesota, two-thirds equals four-fifths, because if you have a five-member city council, two-thirds equals four-fifths. So, in effect, it's four-fifths. But I'm just kind of wondering, you've done some research on this, and I'm wondering maybe the author can tell me where the bill is going, and then maybe you, Mr. King, could tell me how the administration feels on this. Do we have an opinion from the governor where this is heading?
Representative Beard?
Madam Chair, the bill, as amended, if it passes committee, will go to the general register. I am not at this moment have no plans to pre-conference it with the Senate file. However, there will be a Senate bill. I imagine that it won't line up with this, and as I mentioned to Representative Hornstein, my commitment is to continue to work on the project. I want to be careful we don't end up with committee work on the floor, but I think there can be some tweaking that can be done that we can line things up, and you can probably get some signals that there's hate to use this phrase, peace in the valley, and we can go ahead and vote for it without doing committee work on the floor. That's my intention. Thank you.
There was a comment earlier that it passed the Senate. It passed the local government committee in the Senate. It was never taken up on the floor. We did meet with the governor on this in early December and explained our concerns, and he was clear that he thought it was too strong of an attack on local control, and he would veto it as it's currently written. The last thing I wanted to say is the issue that LSP has been most familiar with is the issue of large feedlots, and there was a generic environmental impact statement done on large-scale animal agriculture in Minnesota, and as part of that there was a study on how best to deal with this conflict. When someone wants to propose something in a community that others feel infringes on their property rights, the right to enjoy and use their property, there's going to be conflict. There's no way to avoid that. So the question is, how do we best resolve it? And the determination of the GEIS was the best way is through strong and meaningful local control. That's where people have an input, and that's where issues can be resolved. And it's our feeling that this tips the favor too far tips the balance too far in favor of developers who propose something that's unanticipated and potentially harmful.
Thank you. Representative Beard, do you want to respond, and then Representative Hornstein?
No, I just wanted to ask for, just to clarify the point. It did in the Senate. It passed the committee and went to, what do they call it, general orders, which is where the bill stood at the conclusion of last year's session. It did not pass the Senate. I'm sorry if I conveyed that concept. No, it passed the Senate committees and was on general orders. So, thanks.
Representative Hornstein?
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I just learned from you, Chair Beard, and also Representative Nelson, that this is going directly to the floor. And so, and I know you want to move things along. My thought is, since, Mr. Williams raised some really great concerns, important concerns, ones that I share, Mr. King as well, and I know you want to work with stakeholders, Representative Beard. Just a suggestion, Madam Chair, and I can only vote on something that's before me, and I would vote no on this as it stands. But, I don't know if we would want to continue this hearing. This is the first meeting of the calendar year. We have time, rather than rush something through that would, be a polarizing bill. Maybe there is some hope. I don't know how much, but some hope that some of these concerns can be addressed before the floor, because as you pointed out, Representative Beard, we don't want it to sort of do legislation on the fly and then it comes to the floor and who knows. So just a suggestion that maybe we continue the bill, but it's ultimately up to you, Madam Chair, and the author and others. I just thought I had, now knowing that it's going to the floor.
Representative Beard, did you have a thought on that?
In my concluding comments, I might. Thank you for the comment and suggestion.
Okay. We'll take that up later. Kristen Eide-Polifson. And again, if you could just keep your comments as brief as possible, that would be very helpful. And if you could identify yourself.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kristen Eide-Tollison, and I'm a planning commissioner from Florence Township, Goodhue County. And so I wanted to just share some of my experience about the moratoriums that are going on down there for your information. And I want to say I hope that the committee does do some more work on this bill. These are longstanding issues. And if there are some immediate concerns around the Builders Committee, the Building Committee, or the Building Community, I would hope that the scope could be narrowed so it's not a consideration of any use, development, or subdivision. That does trigger all sorts of unexpected situations with which we're dealing with now. In Goodhue County and all the way down the Hiawatha Valley. I just want to say what is working about the current statute, that is that the ability that local government has to put a moratorium, as Mr. Williams said, is not something we take lightly down in Southeast at all. We don't have individual, commissioners saying, gee, I don't like this, let's put a moratorium on. We take very seriously the investments and concerns of all of our landowners and all of our investors. And one of my major concerns about a two-third vote, which has been discussed, is that immediately polarizes something, politicalizes it. The goal of an interim ordinance should be to get everybody closer to on the same table, to take the time and the opportunity for study. We will probably have to go beyond 1 year, and the passage of this would would change our ability to do that. I just want to quickly describe the process that's happened down there. Citizens brought this concern about the potential sand mines to the county. There were lots of meetings. There were some public meetings that were held by citizens, and a moratorium was passed. A study group was formed. That study group is proceeding to define and refine the questions, and now they're hiring a consultant. And then all of that will need to go back through the public process to be properly vetted, to get everybody on the same page, so that we can move forward. So I'd like to just say what an overwhelming responsibility it is. It is as a local government, particularly as a township. In our township, we are located in the Hiawatha River Valley, and the responsibilities that we have are not just for our individual lands, but for the bluffland, which is so beautiful, which so much of Minnesota enjoys. Bluffs rise on both sides around the valley, and we take very seriously our responsibilities for enforcing the comprehensive plans and the goals and the community values. I see that the new amendment incorporated the community value issue around adult use businesses, and that's great, but that's not the only community value that we have to allow local governments to address and carry forward. So I hope that the committee does more work on this, and that Mr. Beard, or Representative Beard, is, as always, willing to talk to parties so that this can either be focused around the building trades, if that's the issue, or adjusted so it doesn't undermine that fundamental tool that local governments have to have to enforce their health and well-being and community values. Thank you.
Representative Beard?
Madam Chair, do you have any other individual citizens who have traveled here to testify today?
I don't believe so. I have.
So we have the professionals now?
I think we might have a professional or two who'd still like to talk, but well, I think
those
that's
folks,
it for
they know they. I have an open-door policy with them, and I know we've got two or three other bills where we've had citizens travel here that need to talk today. So, Madam Chair, if I could ask the committee if they would lay the bill over. This is one I think needs a little more dwell time, and we can work among ourselves, and particularly with the representatives of township, cities, and counties. I know they've been just doing yeoman's work with me and with the Builders Association to this point. So if they're okay sitting on their testimony until the next time around, Annalee and Kent and so on, I'd ask that we just lay the bill over, and we'll bring this up again, okay?
I think that's a good idea, Representative Beard, based on the comments from committee members. So I'll lay it over, and we have, that looks like the township cities are okay with it.
Unless there's somebody that's made a special trip to come.
Is there anybody
today
that's made a special trip that needed to comment on this today?
Outstanding. Thank you. And thank you, members, for the good talk. I appreciate that.
We do have one person in the back who wanted, if you could make a brief comment. You just identify yourself, and then we'll move on to, I think, Representative Banyan's bill, if he's in the building.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Kiselishan. I served as mayor in the city of Roseville from 2000 to 2004. And what I briefly wanted to say is that I do support House File 389. I think this is an excellent bill, and from my perspective, I have seen this moratorium process firsthand crush small and medium-sized businesses, local residents. These moratoriums can be enacted to go after individual homeowners. Essentially, if you don't have extremely deep pockets, the current process we have today will crush anyone unless you have extremely deep pockets. I've got one or two examples that I could share with the committee, but I know time is limited, so I will just speak with the bill author with these issues later. But what I did want to add here is there was a comment about the sexual-oriented businesses. Now, I know that's been exempted in the current provision here, but the question that I would ask is that, in my opinion, there is no excuse for cities, counties, or townships that are not proactive on issues. In Roseville, I read an article in the Star Tribune about these type of businesses, and rather than wait for one to come to Roseville and then act in a panic fashion, what we did is immediately address the issue, adjusted our laws before we had anyone apply to put one of those businesses in Roseville. And so I would raise the question, is the problem about the proposed language, or is maybe the problem that exists in some counties and townships and cities is that they choose to act reactively rather than proactively? And that's, I think, a tough question that needs to be asked. Because in Roseville, during my tenure, I chose to act proactively, because I think acting in a crisis is always just a disaster. And these moratorium processes in Roseville, in the one brief case that I'll mention, in order to try to drive a business out of the community, the city spent $100,000 conducting a study to determine whether people wanted to live next to a shopping mall. The study was a complete sham. The whole action was about trying to prevent a grocery store from coming into Harmar Shopping Mall. Thankfully, the developer had deep pockets, really deep pockets. Thankfully, the mall had very deep pockets, and after a year, the grocery store was built, and it's a very popular destination for people in the community. But it wasn't popular with a couple of people on the city council at the time who had a friend or two in the neighborhood who simply had the attitude of not in my backyard. So I support this legislation. I hope it moves forward. I hope it's signed into law. Thank you.
Thank you. Since I'm laying this bill over, we will move directly. Thank you, Representative Beard. We'll move directly on to House File 673, Representative Banyan. Representative Bannon, state government finance?
Yes.
Okay, the chair will move that House File 673 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. You want to proceed with your bill? Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. 673 is a fairly simple bill, and I'm always told there's no such thing as a simple bill. And so I always figure if I think a bill is simple, I better bring some explanation with me. And so I will have a testifier here for you in a moment sitting next to me. What's the problem we're trying to solve? The problem we're trying to solve is that sometimes succeeding legislators don't know the intent of a bill as it comes before as they read it. Working a new legislator, which I still am, find out the intent of the previous bills that have been passed. It's confusing, not just for us, but it's also confusing for the public. It's confusing to see what it is that bills pass, because we often write these in language that is fairly difficult to read. Thus, we have folks that do research on them, and I think this leads to a problem in terms of a lack of accountability. Legislators pass bills with one intention, and sometimes they end up with unintended consequences. And it seems to me that we ought to be able to say to the public, "Here's what we intended to do with this bill," and then when it turns out it did something else, the person who's done it has some accountability for the consequences of their actions. So what this bill does is ask for a public value impact statement. This public value impact statement specifies a set of information that the chief author of the bill should provide at the time that the bill is introduced or heard before the first committee. Some of those particulars are left to the rules set by the Senate and the House, but that these items should be in the public record. What should go into a public value impact statement? Well, those items are outlined for you in Part B from lines 113 through 124, and I've asked Professor John Spry of the University of St. Thomas to speak here today to testify to that. And with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask for Professor Spry's testimony now.
Okay, Professor Spry, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Yes, my name is John Spry. I'm an economics professor at the University of St. Thomas, but I appear before you solely as a private citizen from St. Paul, and the views I represent are solely my own. And so when you think about government policy, obviously, the sponsor of the bill feels strongly that there are benefits to the bill, whether it's a new program or a regulation or a requirement on local governments that would cause a financial obligation. And in making judgments, one of the basic contributions of economics is to list and measure and try to evaluate the benefits and costs. So this is not a new concept. Former President Abe Lincoln, who also was a former state lawmaker, said back in 1848 that there are few things wholly evil or wholly good. Almost everything, especially of government policy, is an inseparable compound of the two, so that our best judgment of the preponderance between them is continually demanded. And so the public value statement that would be required would be a requirement for the author of a bill to state what the anticipated benefits of the bill are, but also the anticipated costs. And it's hard to make a good judgment about the preponderance of costs and benefits without identifying both costs and benefits. It also requires an analysis of the impact on particular groups of the elderly, persons with disabilities, and Minnesotans living in poverty. Because in addition to a somewhat economic accounting exercise of numerical benefits and costs, those costs may have different effects on different groups or benefits that would vary across groups. And so that is included. And then the financial obligations and to local government and regulatory burdens would have a statement as to why the benefits of those, if they're in the bill, would outweigh the costs. So I think in summary, it's a basic, low-cost proposal that would be included with introduced bills that meet the criteria of the law and would provide better information for better decision-making to avoid unintended consequences. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Spry. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Banyan, just I want to be clear how this would work. So this is basically a statement from the bill author. You're not requiring any kind of staff analysis or use of partisan, nonpartisan, non-legislative, or legislative staff to create these. It's essentially a statement from the author of what they want to do or what they're trying to accomplish.
Right. Madam Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, yes.
Well,
Representative
Winkler. Madam Chair, Representative Banyan, I suggest that you just did that when you presented the bill to us. I guess it's not in writing, but it's certainly part of the legislative record, and that's the substance of our debates, is to debate the value in our own opinion and based on some framework. So, you know, I'm not sure if how much we gain by kind of writing it out ahead of time and putting it on a piece of paper, because that is essentially what we do here.
Madam Chair.
Representative Banyan.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Representative Winkler, not all of our testimony is seen by the public. Not all of it shows up on a video. And yes, you can find recordings of it, but to find the recording of our broadcast today, you'd probably have to dig in about 60 to 65 minutes into the podcast to find it. This provides us just a place where, if you think about what our House website looks like, and you will have the text of the bill, you would have House research. If they've done a summary of the bill, that would be there. But you could imagine then there being another entry, being the public value statement, impact statement by the author that would appear on that site.
To follow up, Representative Bernstein.
Thank you very much. Madam Chair, along the same lines, why wouldn't you do this for any bill? I mean, I think that I think you're limiting it to bills that increase spending, but or have regulations. But it seems like almost every bill we have has some sort of public value, one way or the other. And I share Representative Winkler's concerns. It'd be difficult to see how this could really get to the level of expertise that we need and require without some additional staff assistance. And, you know, we just have 14 people laid off from the Senate yesterday, and I'm just not sure practically how this would work. I mean, okay, subdivision 2, line 1.19, if I have a transit bill, of course, it would I would offer that it would have positive impacts on elderly people with disability and Minnesotans living in poverty. So would subdivision 2 then require or, you know, click on that I would then have to provide a public value impact statement for any bill that involves public transit, for example? But I just have a lot of philosophical and practical concerns with this.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hornstein. I think if you had a transit bill that that could conceivably have an impact on people with disabilities, that the author would be asked then to provide some statement of what those impacts would be. That doesn't seem to be something that perhaps that would help in the crafting of legislation. As you're induced to reflect on that, it may help to write better legislation. Not speaking of you personally, you've been here for a long time. You probably can craft some very fine legislation. But I think it would be helpful to all of us to think about what it is we're doing, and going through these steps may help us be more considerate in how we write our legislation.
Representative Scalzi?
Well, I've got two or three questions. One, and maybe you can answer this, is that do you have a fiscal note on this bill? And another one, we already have local impact notes, so that's in law. But would this apply to floor amendments? And then another question would be, who would be decide? There'd have to be some great arbiter somewhere that would decide, for instance, the anticipated costs and benefits of the bill to Minnesota's economy. We would need to have a room full of economists to try to figure that out, because, I mean, it's like making work for attorneys. This would be making work for economists, and they don't always decide. I just don't know that the House and Senate, but maybe you want to, because you're asking the House and the Senate to come up with the process. I'm just kind of wondering those questions. Fiscal note of the bill, floor amendments, and who would decide?
Representative and economist Banyan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scalzi. I haven't done a fiscal note on this bill. My expectation is that when we write legislation ourselves, we don't impose we don't measure off in some way the cost of our time in deciding and crafting legislation. This is simply adding a statement you might write, sort of like here your notes on the side of what was I intending to do while I wrote this piece of legislation. I don't conceive of that as being something that we would normally apply a fiscal note to. And I think certainly when we get down to you know, this bill is going to go to state government finance, and their decision will be whether or not to ask for a fiscal note. And that I would suggest that might be the place where that gets considered. I certainly don't think of that as being something there. No, the bill does not apply to amendments in any way, and that certainly is a concern. But I mean, the idea is not to place too many impediments in the legislative process. I don't want this to be a large impediment, but it is a statement of intention. At the time one's crafting legislation, having this note that you're writing along the side as a statement that will go with it seems to be just simply part of the process. Lastly, this is a statement of the intention of the author. The author might want to go out and try to get some economic advice. That would be fine. But no, I again, as you well point out, that's part of the rules that the House and the Senate would set. Not my expectation that everyone's going to go out and seek out economic advice from that, although my door is always open. If this should pass and someone wants some, I'll be happy to provide it.
Do you have a follow-up, Representative Scalzi?
Yeah, I just would say, you know, I mean, I really share your concern with the impact of what we do here on people's lives and on the economy, but just a statement of the intentions of the author, I just think that this bill is a good goal, I'm very conservative fiscally, and I can just see dollars. That's all I see with this. So that's my concern. Thank you.
Representative Mannion.
I have no comment to that.
Thank you. Okay, we'll move on to Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that was one of my questions, was what Representative Scalzi asked about. How this would be effective with the infamous delete all amendments we get in further committees, and it may not be, the author, would they have to have a statement with every delete all amendment they bring forward, every committee they go to or in on the floor, which can be problematic. But the other thing that raised with me, when you talked about the author's belief of what he thinks this is going to cost, reminds me of a bill that Representative Hornstein and I saw our first year in the legislature, that the author brought forward a bill that in his mind was going to save all sorts of money, but when testimony came forward, it actually raised the cost. And if you don't have some economist or somebody researching the bill before you submit it, you can believe what you believe, but it may not be the actual truth. And I guess that's the concern I have.
Representative Bannion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson. Again, I think the purpose of this is to ask the author, what do you think? It certainly isn't. It certainly isn't going to be a statement of, here's what the actual facts are. That's what we do here when we ask for testimony. That's what our researchers do, both research and fiscal research on bills. That's what they do. But it's often helpful, I think, when I'm looking at a bill to know, so what was the plan with this bill? What were you thinking about? Can you give me some explanation? And we can do that in the private hallways, you and I, because we both walk around here on a daily basis during session. But what about the public? How would the public come to find out what it is that the bill intends to do in sort of a plain language way, with all due respect to the folks in House Research who do write in plain English, but in the words of the person who's actually crafting the legislation, what was their intention in the bill being crafted? That's what I'm looking for, and my real thought is in terms of giving that information to the public, and I think that's important.
Thank you. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bannion, maybe this is just a simple yes or no, but if you've been around here a while, or you will be, if I'm paying attention, I'm awake, and I see findings in legislation, we talk about those. and I think findings are kind of like press releases. It tells why we're doing something, but at some point in the committee process, they should probably drop off. If this bill should become law, would these drop off, or are these going to get put in the statute books as well? So we're going to add two or three more volumes to the statute books.
Representative Bannion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Beard, I'm not sure I understood the question. Well, are you asking whether the impact statements will appear in the statutes if they become law? No.
Thank you. That's what I need to know. Thank you.
Okay. Is there anybody else that would like to testify regarding the bill? Do you have any other questions from members? Okay. Seeing none, I believe I made the motion to, and I will renew my motion, that House File 673 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to State Government Finance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay?
No.
Motion does prevail.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bannion. Okay, we'll move on to House File 1560, Representative Wardlow. Welcome to the committee, Representative Wardlow. Would you like me to move your bill?
Please, Madam Chair.
To State Government Finance?
State Government Finance.
Okay. The Chair will move that House File 1560 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to State Government Finance. To your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This bill is a short little bill that packs a good deal of punch. It does two things. It obliges the referral of contested cases to the Office of Administrative Hearings and their Administrative Law Judges for decision in all instances. And a contested case, of course, is a case where there's a dispute between an agency and perhaps a licensee or another person, a regulated entity or person under the jurisdiction of the agency, and perhaps the licensee wants to a license, say a daycare license or a cosmetologist license, is revoked by the agency and the licensee wants to contest that decision, and the statute or due process requires that the agency make a determination that's a contested case. So all of those cases would be referred to the Office of Administrative Hearings, whereas under current law, in certain instances they're referred to the Office of Administrative Hearings, in other agencies they are not, in other instances they are not. There's no uniformity. So we promote uniformity by referring everything to OAH. And secondly, this bill would confer upon the Office of Administrative Hearings final decision-making authority in contested cases in all instances. Presently, the Office of Administrative Hearings has final decision-making authority only in certain kinds of cases. This lack of uniformity is a result, I think, of the original intent was that the OAH, when this was put forward back in the 70s, I believe, original intent was that this would centralize all contested cases and final decisions would be rendered by the Office of Administrative Hearing, ALJs. But certain agencies had more pull than other agencies and were able to carve themselves out of it. We have lack of uniformity as a result. We give the Office of Administrative Hearings final decision-making authority in all contested cases. We restore the original intent there, the uniformity, and we advance a few very key policy goals. First and foremost, we increase public confidence in the process for contested cases, because we do not permit then, because the ALJ would have at OAH a final decision-making authority in every instance, the agency would not be able to rewrite or go back and revise the decision or the findings of fact and conclusions of law in a contested case after the fact and then go to the Court of Appeals, as happens where the OAH only has the recommended decision-making authority, and go to the Court of Appeals with its revised findings. And when agency gets to the Court of Appeals with revised findings, that would change since the trial was held before the administrative law judge. The agency need only show that there's a scintilla of evidence to support their revised findings. So it's unfair to litigants, and unfair to litigants in the contested case procedure to approach the Court of Appeals on unequal footing like that. And it's also unfair to rewrite decisions after a litigant has gone through the expense of a trial before an administrative law judge. That summarizes the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions anyone may have.
We've got a competition here. I'll start with Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, what was the motion here? Where is this going next?
State Government Finance.
State Government Finance. And oh. I guess, my question, I guess, then probably for the author is, will this stop by civil law as well, or do you anticipate that State Government Finance will be the last stop?
Representative Wardlow.
I am not certain, Representative Simon, the exact path for the bill. But the next stop is State Government Finance. Well, and there will, I'm sure there will be a thorough vetting process. Madam Chair, if I may, there is an amendment, an author's amendment, if someone would care to move it.
Okay, I will move the A1 amendment. Is it just a date change?
Yes.
Did you need to explain it, or is it?
Yeah, just the two date changes. The first one makes sure that this is prospective only, so we're only talking about contested cases that are initiated after August 1st, 2012, and the second date change, reviser needs to present a bill to the legislature to implement this legislation, and it would be hard for the reviser to present the bill by like 2 weeks ago. So,
okay.
That problem.
Any questions for the A1 amendment? Okay, we'll go ahead and vote on that. All in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendment does prevail. And then, Representative Simon, did you have?
Yeah.
Follow up? Okay, go ahead.
I did, thanks. Representative Wardlow, have you talked to OAH about this? And if so, what is their position on this bill?
Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Simon, I have spoken with the Office of Administrative Hearings, and they have indicated that they have the capacity to take on all kinds of contested cases and have final decision-making authority in all instances. And I think that they are well disposed towards this reform.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Representative Simon.
I mean, they may be well disposed towards it, but have they taken a position in favor or against the bill that you know of?
Judge Lippman is here, I see. Perhaps he'd like to address that.
Judge Lippman can speak for the author.
That'd be helpful.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Representative Simon, my name is Eric Lippman. I'm an administrative law judge, the assistant chief administrative law judge with the Minnesota Office of Administrative Hearings. With us here also today is Chief Judge Raymond R. Krause of the Office of Administrative Hearings. I think Representative Wardlow was kindly parsing a little bit of words because the OAH, by policy, because we're judges, never advocates for a particular policy outcome for the legislature. We're delighted to have you make those decisions, and we maintain our impartiality by never making direct pitches or suggesting on behalf of any particular legislation. But I think he's accurate in the sense that if we would move from recommended decisions for an agency to a final decision-making authority, that wouldn't be any different. We call balls and strikes as best we can in each case, whether we're making a recommendation for the agency or would actually be entering a final order. There wouldn't be any additional costs. And there are, as he suggests, some dozen different important areas of law where we do, in fact, render final decisions and not make recommendations to the agency.
Representative Simon?
Well, then this is great that you're here, Judge. This is either for the author or for Judge Lippman. Are there any other states that have changed their Administrative Procedures Act in this way?
Judge Lippman?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Simon, indeed, the most prominent example is a couple of years ago, Louisiana, which has final decision-making authority in all cases referred to it. So much like the model that Representative Wardlow and Senator Newman proposed today, Louisiana has already done with great success.
Thank you. Representative Simon?
My last question, Madam Chair, is just for the author in terms of, you know, potentially what are we giving up here in terms of agency expertise. Obviously, administrative law judges have to, by necessity, be jacks of all trades to some extent, and the agencies have expertise, obviously. So how can you allay the concerns over what we're giving up by eliminating that level of review?
Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Simon, very good question. In fact, I don't think we're giving up anything. We're gaining something, though. We are gaining a little bit clear definition as between the executive branch, well, Office of Administrative Hearings within the executive branch, but as between a quasi-judicial body making contested case decisions and an administrative agency which sets policy pursuant to rulemaking procedures, and we don't want to conflate the two. Policymaking by an agency should not be done on the backs of litigants in contested case proceedings, nor should there be end runs around the proper rulemaking procedures by way of contesting cases and bringing things to the Court of Appeals and what have you. So the agency, yes, has expertise, but the Office of Administrative Hearings has significant expertise as well. And I would also say that the issues referred to the Office of Administrative Hearings aren't going to be exceedingly broad in all instances. And we're talking about, in the case of licensure, for instance, perhaps a daycare license has been revoked for some reason, and the licensee contests that at the Office of Administrative Hearings, and they certainly have the competence to take a look at the facts, hear testimony, and render a final decision.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to say that the OAH doesn't have an opinion on this. I've dealt with the OAH before with some of my cities, and I was just amazed at the good job that they did, and I think that the current process is working very well. I'm not sure that tinkering with it in this case is going to improve the process. I just think we've got a good thing going here in Minnesota.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll is next on the list.
I was just going to ask about the A1 amendment just to see if you wanted to get the bill in the form that the author wanted, so I'm a couple of questions behind.
Appreciate that. I hadn't noticed it. All right. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Wardlow. Right now, I guess I'm not an attorney, so I guess some of these questions may be out of ignorance, but right now, the way that's going, it goes to the department that's overseen by a commissioner that's appointed by the governor. who has to be confirmed by the Senate, so there's some legislative and there's some oversight of that. And the administrative law judges, it's my understanding, are appointed or hired for their positions, but they don't stand for re-election as a regular judge does. They're just basically there at the pleasure of the department or of the Office of Administrative Hearings. I guess where's the oversight on this if we end up with a bunch of appointees from either side of the aisle that become activists? I mean, and try using the fear we all have out there is activist judges writing law or writing things that may not be proper or may cause problems, other problems down the road. What can you do to alleviate me of that fear that this may not be the way we want to go and may cause us to have problems down the road?
Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson, as Representative Scalzi was saying, this process, the administrative Office of Administrative Hearings has been doing a fine job, has not been writing law, but has been making sure that decisions are rendered pursuant to existing rules and laws for some time now. It only makes sense to expand that or to create uniformity so that all contested cases go through the Office of Administrative Hearings. And we also have, in addition to any concern about activist judges one may have, and I don't think there's any real concern there because these are relatively narrow disputes regarding within the jurisdiction of an administrative agency regarding either a statutory right or duty, what have you, or statutory right or duty under a rule-based statutory right or duty, excuse me. So we do have another concern, and that is agencies stepping outside of the bounds of rulemaking procedures and taking unto themselves too much of what may seem to be or may in fact be legislative authority and crafting policies either by doing an end run around OAH or by not following with precision rulemaking procedures. And I think that this is one reform in the package of other reforms that I could envision for us today, but to rein in a little bit agency abuse of authority and over delegation of legislative authority.
We'll move on to Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Wardlaw, have you been in contact with these executive branch agencies that are, you know, directly impacted by this? Has there been some conversation in terms of addressing some of your concerns, you know, without legislation or any reaction to this idea from them? I know we have a few here, but I don't know. I'm asking you as the author if you've been in contact with them.
Thank you.
Representative Wardlaw.
Representative Hornstein, Madam Chair. I have had conversations just this morning with PCA, and I believe this bill originated with Senator Newman, and I think that he has likely had conversations. That's the extent of it for now. Conversations will continue as we move forward through the vetting process.
Thank you.
Representative Winkler.
And Madam Chair, Representative Wardlow, I just want to make sure I'm clear. So I understand the ALJ process or the OAH process, and there's a written opinion and there's findings of facts. It goes back to the agency, and the agency can essentially reverse the decision of the administrative law judge. They can, but they have to make their own separate findings of fact to represent that. And I assume that when it goes to the Court of Appeals, that entire record is available to the Court of Appeals, both the ALJ decision and the agency decision. So the Court of Appeals effectively serves as the backstop on an agency trying to use this contested case proceeding to do policy making or to do rule changes. But if the court, you know, the Court of Appeals probably has some standard of review that they have to use to follow in order to do that. So, you know, these are kind of judiciary questions, I guess. But it seems to me that the current process already has a backstop in place for the concerns that you raised about the agency getting involved after the ALJ decision. So I wonder if you could comment on that.
Representative Wardlaw. And then we do have one person from an agency, I believe, that wants to testify. And I understand that Representative Dill's bill is not very controversial, so I would like to get that done if at all possible today. Representative Wardlaw.
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Winkler. Yes, there is something of a backstop already. The problem is that litigants do not approach that backstop, if you will, on fair footing. Because if an agency has revised its findings of fact and conclusions of law of the administrative law judge, then when you get to the Court of Appeals, the standard for the Court of Appeals when taking a look at the revised findings is that there is a scintilla of evidence to support the revisions. So the agency gets a very low standard, a very low bar to meet in order to have its revision of the decision of the ALJ stamped with approval by the Court of Appeals, whereas, you know, after a full trial has already been conducted at OAH.
Madam Chair, Representative Wardlow, I mean, there is the possibility that the ALJ gets it wrong or misses some significant policymaking expertise that they don't have, and there's a role for the agency to come back in and change that. Maybe the solution is to change the standard of review for the Court of Appeals rather than to make the decision final and not go back to the agency as a filter again. That would be one solution. And, you know, we're running out of time, but I'm also curious. In line 1.9, it says, unless otherwise provided by law, you're striking that language. And it says an agency shall submit to the Office of Administrative Hearing for Disposition. Don't we need a repealer of other areas of law that are inconsistent with that so that we would know what exactly which sections of law we're changing?
Representative Wardlow? Maybe Mr. Shepherd, if that needs to be followed up on, too.
Okay. The revisor's instruction, I think, would take care of conforming statutory changes. Is that correct?
Mr. Shepherd?
Madam Chair and members, mechanically, the way that the bill, Representative Wardlow's bill, works is that there are some other sections of law that would need to be amended, both within the Administrative Procedure Act and outside of it. And in Section 2 of Representative Wardlow's bill, it asks the revisor to present a bill to the next session of the legislature to make those changes.
Representative Winkler. Thank you, Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair, Representative Wardlow, I know you're fond of the revisor and revisor's bills, maybe we've done this before and I don't remember it, but it seems to me that we should understand the implications of the sections of law that would be affected by this policy change before voting on it. I think it would be better to include a repealer or corresponding changes of law in this bill. You know, there may be this may be reasonable or not, but it seems to me that changing the standard of review would address it more simply, and we need to understand all the things that we're changing by voting on this bill.
Representative Winkler, perhaps it does go to state government finance next. Perhaps Representative Wardlow could address that issue in the meantime. Representative Wardlow?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Winkler, I'd certainly be willing to take a look at that and make a determination as to whether that makes sense.
It's about the same level of discretion the state agencies have.
Moving on, I think we'll move on to Assistant Commissioner Beeman. If you could just provide brief testimony, that would be appreciated.
Of course, Madam Chair. Thank you, and members. I am Michelle Beeman. I am one of the assistant commissioners at the Pollution Control Agency. My area is in legal and enforcement policy oversight. And just briefly wanted to say, as one of the executive branch agencies that does interact and does have contested cases that go to OAH, we do have some serious concerns about this. We've just had a couple days in which to think about the bill, and we've had just a short opportunity to talk with the author. And there are a number of the other agencies that have some concerns. We have talked with them, the Department of Labor, Industry, and Bowser. So we're trying to sort this out. But just to make quite clear, this would be a very significant change to the Administrative Procedure Act, which has been in place for decades now, governing the process for how executive branch agencies, the decisions that they make that impact regulated parties, how those decisions can be questioned and appealed up. Just again, as a reminder, executive branch agencies are there with expertise to implement the laws, not only to make policy, but to actually execute the laws that are passed by this body. And when decisions are made, they can be challenged by the party affected. In our case, we have a lot of regulated parties with pollution permits, highly technical permits, where there might be a violation, where we have an enforcement action, or where the permit itself is being changed and that's challenged. When a contested case takes place with OAH, the role of the ALJ at that point is to allow for an expansion of the record, is to take additional testimony that the party may want to have there that they feel they didn't have an opportunity to present to the agency or the agency got wrong, to have maybe additional witnesses. The ALJ is the fact finder there and gathers the broader record and makes a recommendation. But the whole point in the APA structure is that that comes back to the agency to make that final decision, to take into consideration that additional information that was held at the hearing. And in some cases, it will change the agency's mind. It will, the outcome potentially in favor of the regulated party, maybe not. Most cases where the PCA's had the situation, we've agreed with the ALJ recommendation. But it, that having that opportunity to at least consider the, that secondary look in that administrative hearing has been very valuable to the agency. And I think these other agencies with concerns have the same thing. This is where the expertise lies, is in the executive agency in terms of the familiarity with the nuances of the law, with what those particular facts were in that enforcement action. And sometimes a decision or a recommendation coming back from the ALJ has multiple parts. There may be pieces that we agree with and would change our decision. There may be pieces that we don't agree with. I think if the ALJ's decision were to be final and become the final agency action on appeal, it could get messy at the Court of Appeals, because we might want the opportunity then to appeal that ALJ decision, but only pieces of it. And so I'm not sure it would short-circuit further appellate work. I also think it doesn't, it just doesn't allow the agency to fully function in its role there. One other point I wanted to make is, to Representative Winkler's point, I think if the concern is about the deference given to the agency by the Court of Appeals, that is a standard of review issue, and I'm not sure having the ALJ be the final decision maker or not really changes that. So that would be something to look at if that's really the concern. And also, just to clarify, in terms of cost on the regulated party for this, the agencies cover the costs of administrative hearings. So I don't think that that should be the overriding concern in this situation. But for the main reason of changing that dynamic and changing the opportunity of the agency to make the final decision, which is what the APA contemplates, that's why we have a concern about this bill.
Thank you. I'm not seeing any questions. Any other member questions of any Representative Wardlow or Assistant Commissioner? Representative Wardlow, did you need to wrap up your testimony? If not, we can proceed to a vote.
Let's proceed to a vote.
Okay. I will renew my motion that House File 1560 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
Amendment or bill does pass. Thank you, Representative Wardlow. And if members don't mind, I'd like to take up, I know we're running a little late, but you can be patient here. We can probably wrap this up rather short and quickly. Okay, Representative Dill, House File 1810. Thank you for your patience. I know you've been waiting for a while. I'd be happy to move your bill. Does it need to go to Environment and Natural Resources? Correct? Okay. I will move House File 1810 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. To your bill, Representative Dill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. The bill, a component of the bill, establishes the Lutz and Poplar River watershed over four sections of land which would represent what you would believe is to be around the ski hill and the condominium developments and the private homes around the ski hill just above the lake. It authorizes no tax of any kind. The district would be voluntary for those who want to participate in consuming water that the district would provide. It is different than a watershed district in that a watershed district is formulated under Chapter 103 of law, state law. It is not very mystifying, and it is necessary in order to operate such a substantial piece of infrastructure in a community. We did in my community exactly the same thing in my community of Crane Lake to operate our new sewer system that is around the lake and all the businesses. I stand for questions. This is just a necessary component of, and it has the blessing of the Department of Natural Resources, the Governor's Office, the Cook County Board, and I have received only one negative comment about the bill since it was introduced, and that's by someone who lives 40 miles away and not in the district but within the county.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I also support the bill. And I just, the only question I have is this to help solve the problem we had last year about the ski area taking water out of the trout stream, and this would stop that from happening and actually be better for the trout stream and for the natural environment up there?
Representative Dill.
I don't know if it's better for the trout because there aren't any trout right in that area where the water is taken out specifically. That was the debate last year. Yes, the answer is yes.
Thank you.
Any other questions from members? I'm not seeing a lot of questions or sensing a lot of controversy, so I'm not sure if anybody needs to testify. If anybody's dying to testify, we could take a minute, but I'm not sensing a lot of opposition. So with that, I will renew my motion that House File 1810 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion does prevail. Is there any other housekeeping business?
Thank you.
Nope. Seeing none, I will adjourn the meeting.